Hello and welcome everyone to the Project Scars podcast. My name is Seth Miersma and I am joined today by two of my favorite gentlemen in the business in the world. Let's be honest. We've got from Southern California, Kyle Hyatt.
It me. Hello.
Also from Southern California, Brett Evans.
It also me. Hello.
Well done. Happy Wednesday, guys. Stoked to be back on the podcast with both of you. Brett, we didn't know that we were going to get you, so you're like a Brett of fresh air in our podcast today.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. I love it so much.
I like to say I was working on it, but honestly, that was just right off the old dome.
That was great. Well done.
Did you have an interesting weekend? And we missed you all last week. So what did we miss in the world of Brett?
Last week I was in Minneapolis driving the GV80 coupe. Right. You can read that review on carid.com/drive. And it was a great weekend, or a great week rather. It was a really nice, Minneapolis is beautiful, very clean, very like pretty city. The GV80 is a very pretty coupe styled crossover. And I think it's probably the best looking in that segment. So yeah, it was a nice week. And then this weekend I'm repping my Out Motorsports Track Cross t-shirt because we had a weekend at Streets of Willow doing point-to-point track cross in Noah's R53 Mini Cooper S. So it was a great weekend.
That's so cool. You'll have to drop if there's a link to get that. I didn't quite see it on the screen because it was a little low, but I like the 8-bit lo-fi version of that. So you should, if that's available, swag, non-car ID swag.
I wonder. I'll have to go look into it and see if they have it available, and I'll drop a link right here.
And if not, just tell Jake to get on it, you know.
Was that your first time in Minneapolis too? That's one of my favorites. I've only spent a little bit of time there other than one long weekend for a friend's birthday, and I really enjoyed it too. But I'm also a big fan of like medium-sized cities in the upper Midwest. That's kind of my jam.
Yeah, agreed. I've been there a few times before, and I always really enjoy it. This was the first time that, like, you know, I was there for like a more leisurely reason. So we saw like the gold medal flower factory, which exploded in 1991 because apparently flour is more flammable and explosive than gunpowder, which is something I didn't know. So, but that was very cool. Just it had been decommissioned already, and I don't think anyone was hurt, but they turned it into like an event space and a museum. So that was really fun. I love Minneapolis. I don't know if I could handle the winters there. I think my skin's gotten a little bit thin since moving to Southern California, but the city itself is fantastic. Great people, great, you know, amenities. Loved it.
Nice.
Great history with music, you know. That's the thing. I always wanted to go there for that reason.
Yeah,
I've heard there's a lot more music there than like it has a right to have.
I've never done like the Prince tour stuff, but that's obviously like Paisley Park is out there and things like that. But it's got like really deep sort of, you know, like grunge, pre-grunge band roots and lots of like, obviously like funk and things like that too. So Minneapolis is one of those a little under the radar. I mean, it's probably more under the radar for you guys out west than it is in the Great Lakes region, I guess, because it's a pretty easy flight from Detroit. But I dig it for sure.
I do just want to interrupt really quick and show you guys what I found on the swag department. There is not this particular shirt available on their website right now, but you can get this Live, Lap, Love t-shirt, which I think is fantastic. Holy smokes.
That's great. Yeah.
I love it, and I also hate it, which is
perfect. I know. It's so great. Just the font is perfect. The sentiment is phenomenal. It's all I want out of life.
We've got a few people joining in the stream, so let me take a break quickly. One to say, hey, thanks for joining us. I promise we're going to talk about cars, not just Minneapolis. This is not, after all, a travel podcast, I don't think, usually.
Not with that.
Lamborghini, 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 Lamborghini. We're going to talk about that and cool old, you know, German cars, I'm positive. And before we jump into any of the main topics and hear what's going on with Kyle's Garage, which is always a topic of interest, I want to let you guys know that we are presented by CarID.com. Fix it, upgrade it, customize it. CarID.com is your car parts destination. We are also presented by the CarID Drive blog, where you can find amazing stories about cars, owners, and incredible builds, unbelievable driving adventures, and hopefully get inspired for your next automotive project. That's the goal. That's the ultimately goal. Ultimately the goal here, guys, inspiration. So
it's a dream.
Yeah. With that said, what's happening in your garage, Kyle?
Well, I put a bicycle in it for the first time in a really long time. Yeah, I bought, this is like the nicest, like newest bike I've ever owned, which is pretty wild. Let me show you what I got. Any second now, wait for it. It'll be great. Hold on.
I'm just imagining something truly spectacular.
Boom, right there.
We're going to add that to the screen. Yep, boom.
Speaking of Minneapolis, Surly is from Minneapolis area. It's a lovely, it's a steel bicycle, which I'm a big fan of. I used to live in Portland, Oregon, which will probably surprise no one. And I biked a lot there. I didn't even have a car for quite a long time while I was there. And I had a Surly. This is probably like 20 years ago now. Oh God, did I just, 20 years ago, 2004. God, nope. But anyway, so I had a Surly, a different kind of Surly, and it was phenomenal. And so I got this one because I wanted to start riding a bike again, in particular with my wife, who she has an e-bike and it's cool. And I don't really like e-bikes because they're just super heavy and I'd rather just ride a motorcycle. But it's rad. But it turns out, and I, you know, this may be a surprise to no one, when you don't do something for a long time and then you go back to doing it, it's hard and not that cool.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of work to do before me and the Surly are on really good terms, but it's got 11 speeds and disc brakes, as you can see. It's pretty sick.
Safety first. It looks awesome, man. I've heard that Surly's are really good. I've never ridden one before, but I love the brand and they're popular around me too. Are there not like six brands of Pacific Northwest bike builders that get upset when you buy a bike from the Midwest and not from your homelands?
No, because nobody can afford that, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because they're all like $9,000 to start.
Yeah,
right?
this one was like I traded in another bike project that I had picked up that was ended up being too much work and weird like 90s bike standards, and a couple of old bike parts and stuff that I had lying around. So this was not as brutal to my wallet and my personal well-being, but it's still I've definitely paid less for a lot of cars, so it's great. I live really close to the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, so we went and tried to take a ride around there, and it was it's been like a million degrees here, so it wasn't great. But
I've had a recent sort of I always knew that bikes were expensive, and I've you know, like kept one tiny fraction of a toe in the bike world forever, basically. But we're looking at a first pedal bike for my 5-year-old right now. And that's been a real eye opener in terms of like the rise in cost of these things, because, you know, you can get like an okay one that's probably fine for him because he'll use it for like a year at his age,
right,
for $100. But it's like complete garbage from what I can tell. But the nicer ones are like start at like $250 to $300. And then I'm seeing like bikes that I see around my neighborhood, I'm checking them out and they're like $500 for a 5-year-old's bike, which seems completely bananas to me.
Yeah. That's a lot, for somebody that's going to outgrow that thing super fast. You know,
he does have a little brother, but the little brother shows so far no proclivity to want to ride a bike at all. We'll see what happens. Well, I suppose we can start talking about cars now, unless there's anything else lifestyle related that we need to get into. I had a really fun weekend this past weekend. Just to jump right in, we're sort of combining the Project Cars and Media Cars thing because we've got a topic that I think all of us can relate to, and that's Lamborghini was kind enough to lend me a very orange version of its Huracan Sturato for the weekend, for a long weekend. I got it last Thursday, turned the keys in on Monday. I drove it a bunch. I was allowed to drive it for 600 miles. And I think I did a pretty damn good job, honestly, you guys. I think I got over 500 miles on the loan, which is good for me in that.
Like
in that.
Six fill-ups.
Yeah. Yeah. There were two for sure. Like I had to keep it going. And a lot of that was, I'm really excited when I have a story put together to share for carid.com, carid.com/drive, because I drove it to Grand Rapids, which is, 120 miles from my house or something like that, to get it shot by Logan Zilmer, who's a really talented photographer that we've worked with a couple of times before. So we're going to have some cool photos to share, which is amazing. So in the meantime, I need to find my own photos of it. which I don't have. But you guys have driven Strada, right? So why don't we start there? You guys both did the launch event, is that right?
We did the launch event together. That's where I got to know Brett, and Brett's muted. Brett needs to get to know the mute button.
Yeah, we were co-drivers on that launch event. That was a lot of fun.
We surely were. It was it was phenomenal. It's one of the best press events I've ever done. And it's one of the few where I've like left feeling actually sad, because I knew that I would never recreate that experience in life. Like having a large Italian man screaming, faster, 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 stay in third, flat, 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 flat. Like going through sand with like a
They had us roost. Set up on like a half paved, half dirt track out at Chuckwalla Raceway. Mm-hmm. And they had they were being completely no mercy in terms of like mechanical they just wanted us to push them as hard as we could. My driver was like, hey, just so you know, if you hit a bump really hard, that's what the skid plates are for, so just go. And I was like, oh, okay, cool, this is more expensive than anything I'll drive in decades, but sure, why not.
It's fascinating that I'm really jealous, number one, that you guys got to have the first drive experience, because as cool, sometimes I would say even often it goes the other way, right? Where we fly out sometimes to drive a car for the first time somewhere. And it's usually a cool place, you know, or a cool event. We get to see friends and it's a new car and all of that. But in terms of actually like engaging with the car, very often it can be difficult to get a well-rounded experience because you're on a prescribed course. You don't have a ton of time with the car in a lot of cases, or like you get plenty of miles, but it's just like, you've got to make your day. You've got to drive to a place and then switch drivers and get back and shoot whatever video, et cetera, et cetera. So having days with the car just in your possession or a week is really fantastic. With Strada, the problem is, well, there are two things. One is, and just like to be upfront about it, Lamborghini, if we said, hey, we want to take it to, you know, an off-road place or do this type of thing with it, I think that they would be okay with it. But just as a blanket statement, they want to get to approve you doing something crazy with the car, because it's this one is close to $400,000 and repairing it is no small thing, and it's got to go to other journalists, et cetera. Right. So I mostly drove it like a completely normal car, as normal as you can drive it when it's a Lamborghini Huracan at heart, meaning I didn't get to do a lot of the stuff that you guys did off road. And so I think I missed like a massive part of what it means to be the Strada. Right.
Yeah, I think certainly like that part of it's rad. I mean, you could have just taken it. What's like the big sand dunes up there? Sleeping Bear?
Yeah, that's up north. And then there's like Silver Lake and stuff on the west side of the state.
I think like the thing that I took away that I was most impressed by, and I've been really, really lucky in that I've gotten to drive a few Huracans. Like it's one of my favorite cars. I really love it. But the problem is that like in LA, there's like, you know, curbs and parking aprons and stuff everywhere. And even with nose lift, you feel like you're scraping things all the time. And it's like a little nerve wracking. Mm-hmm. This thing, you just drive, you can just drive it like it's a car. You know, it's on 19 inch wheels, which is bananas to me. And like, it's reasonably comfortable. And like that part of it is amazing. Like it's, and like the fact that it was kind of done as sort of like a Skunk Works labor of love sort of thing for all the engineers there. You know, like they didn't have one of my favorite stories from the launch. They didn't have like an actual testing budget for the car. So they just bring the mule with them anytime they had to do other testing for other models. Like, oh, we got to take the Urus to Sweden in the middle of winter. Throw the Strada in the back too. And like, so it just piggybacked on all these things, and you know, all these engineers and designers like that were at the program were just like so happy and like excited to show off what they'd made. Like, you know, Reuven and Mitya were just like floored. I mean, just grinning the entire time. And like, that's pretty cool, you know? So.
Well, and you know, in addition to it being a really great daily driver for all the reasons that Kyle just listed, it's also, even if you never go off-road, it's also still a really, really fun mid-engine supercar. I remember on the first drive, on the launch event, like I said, there were some paved sections of the track, and then we also had a really winding route to get to the track in the first place. And all-terrain tires obviously mean that it doesn't have not going to have the super high limits of like a track-focused rubber. But what that meant was you could exploit the car at much lower speeds and have tons of fun, even at like relatively sedate speeds. There was this great final sweeper on the track that, like, the idea was you were supposed to hit the apex and kind of put in a good time. And I remember I was doing a pretty good lap time until then. And then I got to that point and I just saw this wide open sweeper and I just mashed the throttle and the car broke loose in this like phenomenal drift that was so easy to control. And you wouldn't be able to do that in a traditional Huracan because there'd just be too much grip. So like by being a little bit worse, this car I think is even better just because you actually get to have fun with it and play with it.
Yeah, Brett, it's funny you say that. That's what, when I was describing it to a friend, I met up with a good friend. Actually, I went back to Grand Rapids after this shoot this week because a friend of mine was in town and we were chatting about this car, which had just left at that point. And I was describing it as like kind of a Godzilla Miata in a weird way. And I mean that because it does have, because of course, you know, 610 horsepower, 5.2 liter V10 engine. It sounds like God, like it's incredible. It looks and feels and sounds in many ways and like goes in a straight line, like everything that you would expect from any Lamborghini, right? But then because of those tires and because of the like really strange but like fun roll characteristic, like through the suspension, especially on tarmac when you're not really using it, like you have this like extreme progressive slip, right? Even on the road that you can feel. And that's always the thing that I talk about in like low powered cars that I love, like, you know, BRZs and Miatas and other lightweight sports cars, because they tend to be a little bit softer, a little bit less flat all the time. And that's not good if you're trying to get a good lap time, but it's awesome if you're just trying to have fun. Right. So, we had when I was shooting, when we were doing the shoot on this, thankfully Logan knows a lot of good roads around his house. And we were driving really hard on some great roads, like in his area that were short, but they were really windy and like super, like the paving was good, but the paving was undulating, right? Like lots of like secondary sort of movement on this, where this, it was almost like it was perfectly designed for something like the Sturato, because a standard Huracan either would have been fine, but I would have backed off because the nature of the road would have made me think I was going to bottom out all the time, right? And in some cases, I'm sure I would have bottomed out. But with this, where you have the confidence, especially after we did the run a couple times, and you could feel the compliance and the suspension over this, you know, it was almost like a paved dirt track. I know that sounds crazy, but that really is sort of the feeling you got with, because it had so many different undulations. It was just like, oh, this is what it's meant to do. You can feel the car from the door frame up, like the actual structure of the car is as rigid as anything on earth. And then the suspension has got this crazy amount of compliance to it. And those two things in combination are just like, I mean, I don't know how else to say it. It's like a hilarious roller coaster that you can drive, right? It's really fun. So,
with like the greatest intake honk.
Right.
In all of history, like out of all the things to miss about this, the Huracan and this engine going away, it's that sound, like that, like 4,500 RPM where it just like, it just sounds like somebody's stepping on a Muppet, just like, and it, you just, and it just goes, and it's wonderful. Like I always was surprised, like this is the Huracan was the first supercar I ever drove. And I had always sort of expected Lamborghinis to be bad but cool looking, right? Because historically that's been sort of their MO, is like, yeah, this thing sucks to drive, but look at it, right? And like, but the Huracan is a phenomenal sports car. Like it is so driver focused, like the steering's so accurate, the throttle is really well calibrated, the chassis great, like it just, it's way better to drive than it needs to be. And then like the Sturato just sort of takes that and adds more, yeah, like playfulness to it. It's, yeah, wonderful car.
It's awesome that it exists. I love that it has a play, you know, and it's a great sort of swan song, as you know, we haven't really talked about it, but reported on. We know that there's a Huracan successor coming out, and we're positive that it will, you know, like shatter all of the performance benchmarks that this car has set. I'm sure it'll be amazing, but you're going to lose something too. You're going to lose a little bit of that. And it's funny to say this about this car, but you're going to lose an element of analog in this car. Which honestly, when I first drove it years ago, I thought was like one of the most digital supercars I had been in a long time. But that's going to change too. I want to go back quickly to the daily driver thing, because this came up. I also, and I'll put a link to it. Nobody feels the need. It's basically done now, but I didn't ask me anything on Reddit about this car, and I got a lot of awesome like feedback and a lot of really good questions. And that the daily driver thing kept coming up in sort of different ways. And I think both you guys have mentioned that it would be a good, maybe it's more of an LA specific thing, because I get it with the like not having to worry about pulling into parking lots and things like that. My take on that question was, I actually think a regular, despite that, with the nose lift, a standard Huracan is a much more capable daily driving car for two main reasons. One is, and that's why I pulled up this photo, that is not just like a bad, like shadowy area behind the seats. Like that's the snorkel and the louvers. Like you literally can't see, I mean, sorry, not literally. You can see tiny little slots, four tiny little slots in the mirror that basically serve no purpose unless I was on a dark road with headlights coming behind me. I just knew that there were headlights back there, but you can't see anything else, right? So the rear view camera is in the instrument in the center cluster and not like in the bigger screen, infotainment screen. So for me, it's difficult to see all of all the time because I'm tall and I'm looking down on it. So it was cutting off. So actually like learning to go, I was backing this car in almost counterintuitively because I was less scared of doing that correctly than I was of backing in out into live traffic with the setup of the rear cameras of the car when I was parking at places and driving it normally. And then the other one is just because I did a long highway drive, not that anybody would ever commute in the car, but if you were in LA, if you're in a place where you've got to be on a freeway a lot of the time, it's just so loud. Like the tire roar is crazy. So my point of view is that the standard car would be a better car to live with if it was something that you were going to drive, you know, a couple times a week to your job or do something like that. But you definitely have to find your way around bottoming out.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I feel like that never gets enough credit for the Huracan is the turn signal switch. It's the best turn signal switch in all of automotive, period. Like it's so good. As you can see there on the left-hand side, right below the little
Zoom in a bit. Yeah.
Fog light, high beam button or whatever that is. It's like a motorcycle. So you push it to the right, it clicks, you know, there's a really nice tactile sense, and then your blinker's on, and then you push it down to cancel, and it works so well. You never take your hands or fingers off the wheel. It's so easy to use. I'm always, after I get out of an Huracan, I'm so annoyed that switch doesn't, it's like it's not in the Urus. It's like not in any other car. It's so good.
Hard disagree. I hate that switch. Maybe it's because you ride motorcycles and you get, you have more like brain space already, or, you know, pathways dedicated to that in your brain. But I mean, obviously I figured it out and most of the time it's fine. I would say that like 5% of the time the steering wheel was in a position where it was like my hand off the wheel where I was turning and I needed to find it up here or just not put my signal on.
I never had that problem really.
So yeah, it could be, maybe I'm just not signaling early enough. Maybe I'm more of a jerk driving than you are. But and then the other one was because I got a ton of rain when I had the car too. So the opposite switch, as you can see, is for the wipers. That one I think worked a lot better for me, except for there's no real indication when I've got automatic wipers on or off. I think they're kind of always on is what I ended up with. But that one's a little counterintuitive too. But
yeah, see, I've never used the wipers in an Huracan because, you know. What's rain?
That's right.
The whole steering wheel situation is a little overwhelming to me, but that's going to be the case with like any novelty. You'll get used to it if you actually own the car. So yeah, I do remember like feeling the same way about the turn signals the first time we got in, just being like, this is just so silly and confusing and blah, 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 blah. But I bet you'd get used to it.
And then the only, we can leave off this too and start talking about, move on to our next topic, but I want to at least call this out. It's not up there yet, but I shot a reel. You learn a lot of things about vehicles when you're doing photography, as you guys well know, right? Because you need to have like weird situations, park it in strange places, or in this case, like make everything work. So we're trying to make those. You can see that this has the optional, I believe, auxiliary lights on the car. I've never seen a Strato without them. But those lights, in my experience, maybe you guys were able with Lamborghini, they were able to make them work, or they set them up to work. No. Okay.
No, I could never get them to turn on. And I think there was like covers on them or something, like for off-road use only or whatever. And they're like screwed on or something. I could never get them to go on.
So I think that Lamborghini's point of view, at least in the US, is that they're illegal on to use on public streets. And I think that because you are able to turn them on, and we're putting together, like I shot a really quick reel of how to do it that we're going to put on our Instagram. I don't know if Gabriella is watching or not, although that one's not ready yet, but we'll link that out. Maybe I'll put it in the notes on the YouTube video or something like that when we have it ready. But essentially you have to have the automatic lights turned off. You hold down the high beam button, and then there's a toggle switch for it on that row of toggle switches. If I go back to the steering wheel, you can't really see it from that angle, but there's a row of toggle switches that has a light. And then if you hold both of them down, they will go on. And then a warning pops up that says these aren't allowed, something like they're not allowed for use on public roads, right? Sure. So if you hold those two buttons down, you can get them to stay on so you can get a photo out of it. And it's not that hard. But if you don't, they pop right off. So
it's weird because other companies have like LED driving light things, like light bars on their vehicle, like the Tundra TRD Pro that I just reviewed for carid.com/drive has like a great big light bar right in the front. And there's nothing about, you know, that being illegal or whatever.
Yeah. And plus, you know, like Raptor has got like the Raptor lights now famously and the new one. And clearly like there's a lot of stuff happening in the aftermarket that, you know, you can go, it's pretty easy to make your vehicle illegal by putting lights on it on the aftermarket. And it looks really cool and it's great in specific situations, but it might not be specifically legal depending on where you're at. This would be a really interesting story. Actually, it's one of those things that I think crops up a lot. I learned a lot about it in a former job that a lot of replacement headlights that you can just buy on Amazon and stuff actually are illegal, right? Because they're too bright. They wouldn't pass code, especially in places like California where they're a little bit stricter and you do actually do testing and checks on your cars, like you can get in trouble for it. So maybe that's something that we can write up down the road to cover some of that off. I don't know how regional it is, if it's state by state, county by county, et cetera. So, cool. All right. Well, yeah. Fun times with Huracan. Huracan, Kyle, you're saying it correctly and I'm just not ever because I can't.
Huracan.
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 Urus.
Huracan. Revuelto. I don't think that's right, but it's fun to.
That was aggressive on the.
You gotta like roll the R's real hard, like you know.
I feel bad for
Lamborghini.
Go ahead, Brett.
I was just gonna say I feel bad for Lamborghini a little bit because I know in Spain Spanish revuelto means like all mixed up and crazy and like it's named after a bull that was a crazy psycho bull and it's revuelto, but everywhere else in the Spanish speaking world it means scrambled eggs. So I feel a little bad for Lamborghini on that one.
Like, listen, they've got people to check. Well, maybe they don't. It's Lamborghini. Who can say?
Revuelto is okay. We just call it Revuelto. Yeah.
Wouldn't the world be a slightly like a 1% better place if Lamborghini could just use whatever name they wanted to use and not have to do market research? I think I would enjoy that.
Yeah.
I mean, Kuntash is kind of vulgar in Piedmontese. It's like not a polite thing to say around your grandmother. So.
Yeah,
like, but it's like a nonsense word. It's like a kind of a swear, but like not really. Isn't that what it was or something?
It's a word that you would say to like describe a sudden hot thing. Like if someone walked in the room that you just were totally taken aback by, it's a vulgar way of referring to that person. So well,
that's a great name for a pretty vulgar car. Let's be honest.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, I want to drive
Kuntash. She's coarse.
I drove a Uraco years ago, but it was so terrible that it didn't even really count. It was overheating almost immediately. So I think I got the full Uraco experience.
It says showroom condition is what you're saying.
Probably. Yeah, exactly. It also looked like the instrument panel and dashboard were molded from like 70-year-old silly putty. Like, I could take my finger and draw my initials in it if I wanted to. But
oh man,
that's a story for a different day. That's actually that's a hilarious story. But speaking of old cars, speaking of cars from the 70s, at least in one of the cases, we thought it would be fun. One of the items on our list of things to talk about for this podcast would be to pick out cars from our birth year. And I said dream cars, I think, in the description. We left this pretty loose, so there aren't strict rules around it. Brett, you know very well that sometimes I like to create games that have extremely strict rules that you aren't allowed to play unless you're following. But this one is a lot looser. So, it's a fun way to look at cars. I think this is something that enthusiasts do all the time, right? Like high school is another big one. Like if you could go back and buy any car from the year that you graduated high school, like what would you be? Those are super fun. But
I have mine.
Yeah, actually. You own yours. Yeah,
I do. Yeah. Exactly. Graduated in 2003.
That's amazing. Birth year, I think it is a little bit more challenging. Obviously, we're going back a little bit further too. So, and we were talking about it before, we're not really holding to necessarily to cars that debuted in the year that you were, year we were born or anything like that. Just cars that were on sale then that we think are interesting. So, which one of y'all wants to go first?
Not it.
All right, I'll take it.
Excellent.
We're going to stay on theme. And I'm going to choose this guy right here. This is the 25th anniversary version of the Lamborghini Countach. This is the most vulgar version of the Lamborghini Countach for sure. In a panoply of automotive vulgarities, this is about as big as it gets. The 25th anniversary
car, right?
Yeah. So the 25th anniversary has these like outrageous strakes on the sides and then the top of the fender mounted vents. It is just like very aggressive. And I have to say, I don't actually think I like the 25th anniversary as like maybe the LP 5000 or some of those other like earlier Countach designs, but this is kind of just peak Countach. Everything's color matched. This example, for people who aren't watching, everything's color matched. This one is white over white with white bumpers and white body panel accents. So it is just like an aggressively like cocaine fueled Lamborghini design for sure.
But, I don't think it is. I don't think it is specifically. I don't think he had the 25th anniversary, but it looks like the Wolf of Wall Street Countach to me. If you guys remember that,
it is. Yeah, this is that car. I think. Well, I don't know if this.
Did he have a 25th?
It was a 25th white on white on white. Pretty sure.
Yeah. It was a fully coked out car, and I don't know exactly the year. Wait, Brett. Either I missed it, or I'm just bad at math, or both. What year are we looking at?
1989. Birth year is 1989, and the 25th anniversary was I think it was 1989 only, because the Countach came out, or the Lamborghini brand came out in 63.
That's why there's a 63 on the Sturato.
Gotcha. Okay, so this. They just like to lie and say that the 1989, maybe because the 1989 model came out in 1988 during Lamborghini's 25th anniversary. Might be something like that. Whatever the case may be, this is a 1989 and I'm claiming it. So, I actually don't honestly love the, like, I know the Countach is way overblown as a driver's car. I know, like, I was reading a contemporary car and driver review of the LP 400 and they kind of said, like, it's fun, but it's not great. Like nothing, it's hard to drive. The clutch is terrible. Like it's loud and cool, but it's not actually that fast. Kind of on and on and on. And my friend Lynn Woodward at KBB borrowed a Countach to go to her 25th high school graduating class reunion. And she said the same thing. She was like, it looks cool. She wore her prom dress to the reunion in this Countach. She said, I felt very cool in my prom dress with my Countach, but like, it's not a good car. And so I recognize that. Like, I don't actually really like want to drive one of these on a regular basis, but I do they just look so, so superb. And I love them so much.
Yeah. I mean, in 89, we were like, without having it in front of me, like, I'm going to get the exact models wrong, but like there were a lot of like pretty great cars that were really quick that were not supercars and not supercar money that probably outperformed the Countach at that point. Right. So like, I'm thinking like 944 turbos and you know, what there was probably like a very competitive Corvette even that year, you know, things like that, like cars had gotten, I think performance was starting to get more democratized by the late 80s. And obviously that trend continued and continues to this day, I think. But I still love it. I love it as like the ultimate sort of expression of accessorizing by Lamborghini too, like how they were making it swoopier and more vents and that crazy wing. Because the original Countach was so slim and just a wedge and it was beautiful. And it kind of went downhill from a pure beauty standpoint from there, but like amped up the reputation, I guess.
Once they lost the periscope, it was all downhill.
Right. You
know? Well, did Chrysler own Lamborghini at this point too? I think they did. Late 80s. Yeah. So that's also not going to be great for your performance in terms of like late 80s Chrysler.
Well, there was money coming from Chrysler, but I don't think any of the engineering or any of the manufacturing was carried out through them. I think the like main Chrysler Lamborghini crossover came in the design department, because we actually got the Dodge Intrepid from a Lamborghini concept that was like Chrysler co-branded. Yeah, so it was the Lamborghini Silhouette. No, the Silhouette was actually a production car. I can't remember the name of the concept, but it was this obscenely cab-forward, four-seat, four-door sedan with a mid-mounted Chrysler V12. And they took that design and turned it into the obscenely cab-forward Chrysler LH cars. So there wasn't a ton of engineering crossover between the two. In fact, I think the 25th anniversary Lamborghini Countach was designed when it was under French ownership. There was a French family that owned Lamborghini in the early 80s. All right. I think that's when a lot of that design and engineering happened. So, and then there's also some weird, like, because of the gray market import laws in the United States at the time, an American, this was something I learned, crazy. This is such a stupid aside. I don't even know if anyone cares. But so the original Lamborghini Countach's V12 was actually a V12. It had, three rows of two barrel carburetors per bank. And it had, what else? The engine management and everything like that was like fairly integrated. When they brought the V12 over for America in the 80s, they divided the thing in half. So the intake runners literally got divided in half. So the car was essentially functioning as two inline sixes. They didn't have sophisticated enough engine management or fuel injection software to meet American emission standards for a V12. So they gave it two fuel injection systems and two engine management systems, and then split that intake runner down the middle. So the thing was literally running as two very closely coordinated inline sixes. So
that sounds problematic.
And BMW's like, that's a great idea. Let me do that too.
But that's what I'm saying is like there are so many different variants and engineering. This was like a US exclusive thing. Some importer in the United States knew that he could bring Lamborghinis in if he did it this way. And so like there are so many ridiculous engineering differences between European and American market Lamborghinis at the time. And then Chrysler and this French company, like this company was just a mess in the 80s. And yet they still produce something absolutely ridiculous and totally wonky and like the ultimate poster car for everyone of my generation.
It's a super good pick for a dream car for your birth year for sure, compromised as it may be, or maybe because it's compromised. But
because probably, yeah.
Well, why don't we go in reverse cron order then, Kyle, and you go next. What's your birth year and what's your first pick?
Well, we're going back to 1985. Yeah, so not that far, not that much further back, but I'm actually going back to a car where I've actually owned a variant of it. The phenomenal BMW E28 5 Series.
Love it.
That'll do.
Yeah, so this is the 535i. I had a 535iS, which is really, really similar, but just has like a couple extra tacked on body things or whatever. But this is like the most BMW to ever BMW, pretty much. It's got that sort of shark nose and the quad headlights, and it's got 3.5 liter M30 inline six, which is basically a tractor engine. It's, you know, like the interior is wonderful, like full 80s German spec. And they still, like, it's like a nice functional car today. They're so good. Like the chassis really, I mean, it's still an 80s BMW with semi-trailing rear suspension. So it's still like, you know, a total yuppie killer, but it's hilarious to drive. They've held up really well. They're just phenomenal. And like you can still get them reasonably cheap if you're not looking for an IS or an M5.
Yeah, what made you get rid of your IS? That's surprising. I know that those like command quite a premium, certainly in the 3 Series world too.
But. So when I had mine, this was just before I moved to LA. I bought it when I was working at a BMW dealer in Seattle, and it was the county where my parents live in Washington State does not have emissions testing, and so I was able to get away with a lot. Which is to say straight pipe exhaust and like a, there's a company called, I think it's like Miller, and you can convert it from like that big air mass meter barn door thing to an actual mass airflow sensor. And it was like chipped and all this other stuff. And so there was no way it was ever going to pass smog. Gotcha. So yeah, so I ended up selling it for like I did okay on the sale. But yeah, man, what a great car. Like these are, you know, still underrated, I think. People are all obsessed with like E30s and stuff, but the E28's where it's at. And then obviously like the E28 M5 is the first like full-on M car that was hand assembled. You could get it in any color you want as long as it's black with a tan interior in the US. You can get it other colors in Europe. And I'd always wondered like how much better is the M5? Right, like it can't be that much better, but as it turns out, I went to Monterey a couple of years ago with BMW, and one of the cars they had for us to drive was their own like E28 M5, and it's just a completely different animal in terms of like the way the engine. This is like the 535 is all kind of very torquey, whereas the M5 just breathes and revs and feels so smooth, and it's wonderful. So
this was like the first iteration of M cars in America had individual throttle bodies too. So like it just screams. It just sounds good. I had the same. I used to have a E34 535i, and I used to think the same thing. Like, oh, how much better could an M version really be? And I've never driven one, but I went to a Cars and Coffee, and there was one there, and he like ripped it out of the parking lot. Probably in like an unsafe way, but like ripped down the street, and the sound that it made was just like enough to make me be like, oh yeah, never mind. I'm not cool at all in my 535i.
Yeah, that engine, they use it for the E28 and the E34 M5. Yep. Eventually it went up all the way to 3.8 liters in the European E34 M5 and was making over 300 horsepower, which in like the early 90s is nuts. Like that's so much power from like a six cylinder.
The sedan too, especially like V8 sedans made 220 to 250. Like this was obscene power. I think BMW's own V12 didn't even make 300 horsepower at the time.
Yeah, no. Like in the E28 version, I think it made like 280 or something, which again in like 87, which was the first year that the M5 was available. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. So, yeah, first pick.
I love the M version for sure. I think this 5 Series, though, I mean, Kyle, you touched on it already. It's like it's a timeless design. Like there's so much glass. The pillars are so thin. It's got really excellent proportions. This is a car that's going to look awesome, like going down the road or in your driveway for 100 years. You know, like this is always going to look like and it's very endemic of like what people aspire to in terms of like automotive design in this era too. So I think that it's also, it was sort of an important car as well. And it definitely like showed the way forward for BMW for a really long time.
For sure. Plus
I always go back and wonder, like I should read the contemporary reviews, cause I think it's probably a little easier to understand, but I feel like even this was a little envelope pushing in terms of design when it first launched. And I wonder whether or not BMW is just so used to coming into that kind of that sort of criticism that they get like every time they launch a new generation of a car, that it just feels like part of their DNA at this point.
Could be. Yeah.
Because clearly that's happened like, you know, over and over again in the span of my career, but, I mean, this didn't look like anything else on the road in 1985 either, right?
Yeah, yeah. Also, this is the Hoffmeister kink, RIP mostly. Mm-hmm. Just, it's so good. It's such a weird little design touch that made such a big difference in how BMWs looked for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and for those of you not visually enjoying our podcast, first of all, big mistake. Secondly, the Hoffmeister kink, if you don't know, is the little reverse angle, I guess you'd say, in the C-pillar. Mm-hmm. Of BMWs from the 80s and 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, named after, I think it was George Hoffmeister.
Was it a 2002 that first used it?
It was the Neuklasse, but I don't remember if it was specifically the 2002.
Yeah, it was the pre 02 Neuklasse.
1500, like but yeah, so it's a legendary feature. BMW since kind of moved away from that, which is a shame. But yeah, classic. And these things still, the other thing that's really important is that they still drive like a modern-ish car. Like you can easily use one in Southern California traffic in perfectly stock form every day. And it's just like, you don't feel like you're missing out on anything except for maybe infotainment. But yeah, great cars.
Great pick. So I am going to my birth year is 1978, and all of the cars I pick, they sort of go up the ladder from, in my mind, from most attainable to least attainable, personally. Although I think all of them are probably like within reach with a little bit of planning. So what we're looking at now is, this is actually a 1978, I believe, 1978 Volkswagen Scirocco, in a really excellent color that I don't think they ever brought to the US. This is part of the fun of this model for me, is there was such a like sort of like we were talking about with the Lamborghini, I suppose the 5 Series as well, right? Like a real differentiation in this time of what was being offered in the US versus what was being offered in Europe in terms of like engine trim levels and things like that. So at this point, it's a little bit difficult to parse without more research, like what was going on there. But I had a buddy in high school who had a 78 Scirocco. It was one of the first cars that we all like learned to drive in or drove, you know, like learned to drive stick shift in and things like that. And I just, at the time, it's one of those designs that just stuck in my head as being super cool. I didn't know it existed. It was, you know, it's almost hard to describe today to people who grew up with the internet, like how difficult it was to get information about cars pre-internet, right? Like, but I didn't know this car existed. Nobody ever talked about it. And then one day it just appeared in my high school parking lot. My friend Dale was driving it. And I was like, holy cow, what is that? That thing is amazing. Like it kind of looks like a Golf, I guess, but it totally different. So I have a close personal connection with this car as a result of that. And I also just think like the second Scirocco, the Scirocco 2, everybody loves that. Came out in 88 or 89, I believe. Maybe it's even a little bit earlier than that, but it's, I think it's closer to a car that's, I think it's a little bit more iconic these days, especially in the US. I think it's a little bit closer to tuner culture. You could do a lot more, you could get a lot more power out of the engine and things like that. It's great. I think I've driven all of them, but like, I really like that car too. The first one, like the one that launched here in the US, and I think it came to the US first in 75. 75 or 76, less than 100 horsepower. You know, it had a 1.5 liter four cylinder engine that was making very, you know, like not a whole lot of power, not a whole lot of torque, super lightweight. Obviously, kind of, I just found this out. I always think of it as being based on a Golf, but effectively it was, I mean, it had a lot of like Golf running gear, but I think most of the design was done specifically for this car because it was so stretched. This is a Jajario designed car, which is another theme with the ones that I'm picking too. So like really pretty, it looks very light, and I think it is in fact very light. So it would be fascinating for me to get back into one of these cars after not driving one since I was like 17 years old, I guess, because I imagine the experience doesn't quite live up to what I remember it being at the time. But you know, like Volkswagens of this era were their own thing. I think continue to have like a super strong following, and are really rewarding if you're not looking for like outright performance, right? So this is just a very personal pick. I don't know how many people would go to 78 and come back with a Scirocco.
I kind of miss this era of Volkswagen a ton, where like it was like post Beetle, so we weren't quite like bargain basement, and we've kind of like gotten vehicles that had some like genuine like road, what's the word, like road holding potential or whatever, where you could really kind of just like trust the thing to get you down the highway at speed, like with relative comfort and ease. And I really miss that about like, I feel like it like went from this Mark I era to like maybe Mark IV, Mark V, and then kind of started dissipating a little bit. And I really just miss how like everything felt so fine and so high quality in Volkswagens of the era. It was just like so much fun to like just get in and button press. Like everything just felt nice.
Mark IV in particular for me, like that's peak Volkswagen. Like that's the last, like that's when they stopped looking like a Volkswagen or like something completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, after that, they just started looking like every other car. You know, peak crayon smelling era as well, which is very important for me in the enjoyment of a German car. Yeah, but no, this thing's great. I love this. I just sent you a link to our chat, but Brian Scotto, formerly of Hoonigan, actually has like a rabbit or a Golf. I can't remember which it is.
Oh, neat. Yeah.
And it's like one of the ones that was built in Pennsylvania or whatever, but it's the same color. And he daily drives it down here.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's great. He's like the biggest Volkswagen nerd, I think, ever. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a great color. And yeah, like the Volkswagens from that era are super cool. They're super fun. And again, just like doing things differently than anybody else. Like they felt much more like quality objects. So
I remember when, when Volkswagen started doing cars in Tennessee, like we got like the NMS Passat built in Tennessee. The Westmoreland Rabbits, which is what we're looking at, the ones that were built in Pennsylvania, they were like a serious problem for the company because they had worse interior quality and like a less buttoned down driving experience than German built or Mexico built Volkswagens. And I think it's really funny that like, I know the Chattanooga built Volkswagens are best sellers. I know they're doing really, really well for the company, but it is just funny to me that like in the 80s, the auto market rejected American built Volkswagens for the exact same reasons that in the 2000s, 2010s, the automotive market has accepted American built Volkswagens.
Yeah. Turn it on its head. I have one fun fact, one Scirocco fun fact. Maybe you guys know, because you're smarter at cars than I am, but, apparently the Scirocco actually launched before the Golf, at least in Europe. I've got my notes open now. It was 1974. Scirocco actually launched 6 months before Golf did in Europe, I guess is a reason they didn't want to sort of clutter the launch of what they knew was going to be a huge mass market play with the Golf, with this car that they expected to be a lot more, you know, niche. And sell a few. Although I also found out this is all from a Volkswagen article. They did kind of a retrospective piece, which is really cool. They peaked, at least in this first generation, they sold almost 90,000 of them in 77, which was the peak for the first generation. 87,902 in 77, which is wild to me because I never knew that this car had that much volume. I've got to imagine a lot of that was in Germany. They say globally. But even still, that's far more successful than I expected it to be. But
yeah, it's related, I guess. I always can get to the Scirocco and the Corrado. I always get confused. Yeah. Did the Corrado replace the Scirocco in the US or was it like, were they separate models? This seems like something Brett would definitely know.
I think they overlapped, but I think it like spiritually was a replacement. Yeah.
Yep, you nailed it. I think the Corrado, I'm not going to guess, I'm going to get actual answers, but the Corrado was like effectively the replacement. And by the time the Corrado VR6 had come around, I know the Scirocco was out of production, but yeah, 1988 was the first model year for the Corrado, and I think that was also the same as the last model year for the Scirocco.
Both phenomenal looking cars.
The other thing,
Scirocco made it all the way to 1992. So yeah, right about the time that the Corrado VR6 came around is when they discontinued the Scirocco.
Interesting.
The other half of that, which maybe I would have guessed if somebody asked me at trivia or something like that, but it took me by surprise when I was reading it today, is that the Scirocco is actually the direct replacement for the Karmann Ghia Coupe. Which I just think of those as being so totally different, you know, from completely different eras. But if you think about it, they showed it first in 72 or 73, you know, in Geneva or one of the big European shows. So it makes sense that Karmann Ghias were sort of just like tailing off at that age. But what a fun time for, well, I mean, you started there too. Like mid 70s were such a fun time for Volkswagen. Go back and look at their lineup. I started there looking at what they were selling in 78 in the US, and it's like Transporter, they still had Beetles and Beetle convertible, you know, Golf was on sale, Scirocco was on sale. They had a pretty full model line, and all of them right now are cars you'd be like, that's cool. Like if you saw it at a Cars and Coffee or something. So
that's kind of a funny thing about, like, I mean, I guess there's probably a thesis there that like the peak of, or not the peak, but like, you know, one of like the real exciting times to be a foreign car maker coincides with one of the real depressing times to be an American car maker. Like Volkswagen was doing weird things. Honda had the CVCC engine technology. That was like so really cool. Toyota was like just first starting to make like the 4x4 truck and like some of their, you know, really interesting products coming around. It's kind of curious. Like
Lamborghini was splitting its fueling in half for its V12.
Right. it's kind of curious that like the lower market manufacturers were like doing some really interesting things at the same time that like some of the really established brands were having a hard time. So I'd be interested in doing like a philosophical thesis on why that is.
Yeah. US
I'm sure it's been done a million times.
Hell of a drug, I think, is the, is the title there. When you can or cannot sell your car here based on like new CAFE standards and things like that, I think you're seeing some invention and some really terrible things. Yeah, to your point, like there were some crimes perpetrated on the American public in the mid 70s. That's for certain.
And diving board bumpers, get out of town.
Oh, I love diving boards. I'm not gonna lie, I love a good diving board.
We're going back to you. We're already approaching an hour here, so we're gonna pick up the pace, or we're gonna cut it at two cars. I don't want to leave any cars on the table, but we're, as usual, rambling about old stuff. So
rambling indeed. Let me show you. So this is my other. I actually only prepared two, so we can skip me for round three. But this is my other choice. This one actually did debut during my birth year, so I really get to count this one, no matter how you slice it.
Yes.
I love the Taurus SHO so much. I love it so much. The only way that it could possibly be better for me is if they did a Sable version with the full light bar and the station wagon body style. I love the Taurus SHO so much. So this is my pick. Yamaha designed V6. The Taurus was already like oddly a pretty decent, like decently tuned car in terms of like suspension and ride and handling balance and everything like that. And then the SHO just kind of brought 215 horsepower, something like that, and a mandatory Mazda 5-speed manual to the mix. And I just think it's fantastic and I love it.
They're phenomenal. They're so cool. And like, it's funny because, you know, when I'm in like high school or whatever, Tauruses from that generation were what everybody's moms drove, and they're all clapped out, crappy, with no clear coat left on them. And it's hard to forget, or it's easy to forget rather, that the Taurus was actually like a super high tech, really well engineered, thought out, like, car. It was a cool car.
Speaking of BMWs, this was the fastest, either the quickest accelerating or the fastest four-door sedan on the market at the time. So when the Taurus SHO debuted, it was even faster than that E28 M5 we were just gushing over a few seconds ago. Mm-hmm. And then it continued even after the E34 M5 came out. They applied some modifications to the Taurus that still kept it in that like rarefied list of extremely fast four-door sedans. So kind of a randomly awesome vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. I once saw somebody had swapped, I think it was like a series two Lotus, Esprit, and they swapped the Show V6 into it. And I was like, man, what a perfect engine swap. Like, it makes so much sense. It should have been that way from new, you know. Shout out Conan O'Brien, who still has his show.
So that the V6 is such a great engine. I only had one experience driving it. So former colleague, good friend Chris Smith, is a like noted. Do you guys say show or SHO, or are you just in between? Like, just,
it depends how I'm feeling that day.
Well, in that community, in the show community, like he's owned a bunch of cars and written a lot of stuff too. And I think it's fair to say an expert. He brought a car into town, when he was doing some freelance work for us and let me take it for a drive. And I'd obviously heard about it, but I'd never been in one before. And, you know, of course, at that point, mid, you know, 2009 era, something like that, the car didn't feel particularly fast. And honestly, like, it didn't feel particularly sporty even relative to sports sedan of the time. But dude, that motor at, you know, $6,000 or higher or something like that, like revving, just sounded incredible. All of the stories of the car sounding super exotic when you were revving it out were absolutely true. And that, like, you know, still made it feel really special even years later in a not pristine example, just like a nice driver. So I love this car. I love it. It's such a wacky mashup of like mass market. And to Kyle's point, like, I mean, I was, when this car came out, I was 11. Like, I was well aware of cars. It was all over the place. It was, you know, wallpaper, right? Like, we talk about that a lot, but especially in Western Michigan, this car was literally everywhere. So to see something like that, that had some real performance behind it at the time, was a little mind blowing.
Just think, like, anytime Yamaha gets involved in an engine in a car, it's always phenomenal. Like the V8 from the Volvo XC90, the first generation, Yamaha designed, spectacular. They also did the engine for the Toyota 2000 GT, legendarily cool.
Yeah, I was going to say, they did the 2000 GT. They did the Lexus LFA's V10 had some Yamaha input. They actually did this. The Yamaha Musical Instruments did the sound design for the Lexus LFA V10. Like
the tuning fork brand, man.
They do some. They do some like pretty awesome stuff when it comes to cars. I did get curious what the test results for this SHO were. 0 to 60 in 6.7 seconds and a top speed of 143. I'm not gonna like besmirch those. Those are like properly like faster than normal traffic. But it is so funny that like such a legendary vehicle in I think like the collective automotive consciousness can't outrun a modern Toyota Camry V6. Like that's kind of entertaining to me. But
in 89 that was banging, man. Like
well, that's
that
what
was...
I'm saying. Like
that was
fast. Outrageous power for sure. Like outrageous speed for anything, for any car, much less a four-door sedan. But it is just really funny how incredibly far we've come in terms of like regular ass traffic performance. It's really entertaining to me.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, Kyle, you're up. What do we got next?
I'm well, you know, I got to stick with Europe. That's me. It's my disease. We're going to a different spot. We're not going to Germany. We are going to
Great Britain,
France,
Italy,
Modena.
Yeah.
These cars got a really bad rap. Like people gave them short shrift for a very, very, very long time for being kind of just like boring and wedge shaped. And it was like the Rain Man Ferrari. People didn't love them. I have always loved these things. And as far as like 80s Ferraris go, I've always been partial to front engine V12 Ferraris. Like that's it for me.
Super cool.
And that's what you get in this thing, you know, like it's still like the Colombo V12, I think. You can get it with a 5-speed or with a totally sweet GM 3-speed automatic.
3-speed automatic, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say for everyone listening afterwards, this is the Ferrari 400i that we're looking at, 1985. Oh.
This is actually, I think technically, in they have this mislabeled because I think in 1985 it was the 412, but those are all functionally the same car with like just a different name. It was more or less the same car from like the late 70s until like I think it was done in like 89 or 90 or something. But this is the spiritual successor to the Daytona, right? So it's got some Daytona styling features like the sort of driving light turn signal things in the front. A lot of glass, you know, great greenhouse. It's very long, low, stretched out. V12, I mean, what's better than that? They made it forever. And it just doesn't like have that sort of 80s stink that like a Testarossa does or like a 308. And a 308's not that nice to drive. It's like a truck. I haven't driven one of these. I would imagine it's probably about the same, but like it looks cooler. I love these. And these were like super, 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 super cheap for a really long time. And you know, this one, as you can see, sold last summer for $121,000. So like cheap 400 Ferraris. Those days are gone. Always love these things.
I suppose that's still inexpensive as like classic Ferraris go, but yeah, the days of being able to pick one up for like 30 grand or something are long past. That's too bad. I have a conflicted, like if you scroll back down to the profile shot of that car, that's what always gets me when I see like, oh, this is actually like a really beautiful, it almost looks like it should be kind of a modern Maserati to me, like a modern take on like a 60s Maserati, just because of that. You know, like really cool roof line, like, and long nose and things like that. The front doesn't quite do it as much for me. I would love to drive this car. I bet this is an easy car to fall in love with when you're actually behind the wheel, just because it's so unique.
I would imagine so. And it's sort of like the predecessor of my favorite Ferrari of all time, the 550 Maranello, which I did get to drive last year, this time last year. Sotheby's actually let me drive one that was going up for sale in Monterey, and it was like Tour de France blue with like a Crema interior, 5-speed gated manual. Unbelievably nice. Like it's
the perfect
exactly
Ferrari.
Yeah, it's exactly what I wanted it to be. Like it's just like it was plenty of torque, everything was like sort of comfortable and sedate and stuff, and then you step on it and the V12 just howls, and it's phenomenal. So there we go.
I empathize slightly with the 400 412i or the 400i 412 whatever the taste for it. I don't like them at all. I don't think they're very attractive or anything like that. But the other like maligned Ferrari of the era is the Mondial, and I love the Mondial. And so I fully get where you're coming from, Kyle. And again, like the market used to be so attainable. You used to be able to get Mondials, 400s and 308s for like $20,000 all day long in like decent condition. Mm-hmm. And the market, you can't get any of those for less than 50 anymore. Like it's impossible. And so the days of the like truly attainable 80s Ferrari are fast in the rearview mirror.
There used to be a guy, I imagine a lawyer, but it was a car that was parked in a small parking lot for a lawyer's office in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that I would walk by in the summer anyways, always had a Mondial out there. So it was like somebody kind of like daily driving the car. This is maybe 12 years, 15 years ago or something like that. So it was at the point where it's like, well, one thing that always struck me about those cars too, not to get off on a tangent, but I was like, I was confused the first couple of times I saw it from like the road in an elevated parking lot. I thought it was an MR2 because of the size. They're small. They're tiny, tiny cars. And you don't expect it when you, based on I didn't expect it based on seeing it in photographs too. But yeah, they certainly have, I don't think that would be a car that people would be super comfortable just like driving downtown to work Monday through Friday.
And I think to your credit, Kyle, the like 308 and the first couple iterations of the Mondial, like that that V8 was just like so neutered and so wheezy. Yeah,
really wheezy.
And I think the 400i and the 412 avoided a lot of that. I think that they like still kind of maintain some of the allure and some of the like drama of that Colombo V12, even if it had emissions controls and stuff like that. I think they still kind of maintained a little bit of that Ferrari mystique, you know, maybe let down a little bit by some like styling by Ruler and Ruler alone. But, you know, that's definitely some people's taste for sure.
Yeah, I think it just had a different mission too than like the Mondial or the 308, where it's like it's meant to be comfortable and long legged. And, you know, with the right gearing, you can make anything feel like long legged. So as long as it sounds good.
So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Seth, fire away.
Well, that's a good transition because this is definitely in the GT space. So we're looking at
there we go.
First year for the Porsche 928 was the first model year, I believe, was the 1978 car. One of you guys will probably that was way too much zooming.
Teledials, hell yes.
This is a car that like I've always had a great fondness for. I've gotten to do a couple stories about over the years. So I've driven, I drove a private example early on in my career in the early 2000s and really, really liked this car. Did this sort of deep dive on it. You know, this was quite famously like supposed to be Porsche's answer successor for the 911 when the 911 sales were flagging in the early 70s. And they put together the 928, which is a front engine rear wheel drive car. Some people call it, you know, at the time called it like Porsche's Corvette type of deal. It's got a 4.5, I think at this point, 4.5 liter V8, 300-ish horsepower. No, it wasn't quite 300 horsepower in the like 250 range. Just like really, really incredible to drive in a way that was, I think at the time, like surprising from Porsche because the handling tended to be much more focused on what would work really well on the track, making a lot of the cars more difficult to drive for unskilled drivers who like to own Porsches up to that point. So I think that they were looking at broadening the audience here too. And then for those of you watching or have seen it before, you've got this design, which is, I don't even know, like, there's this like extremely short rear deck, long nose, low hood, you know, for the time, really large wheels. I think like it just created a profile that I think was absolutely unmissable and really exotic for Porsche and quite beautiful. And then I had to make sure this is an awesome one too. I don't remember what auction site this came from, but this is obviously a nice car. We've got a good engine shot there, which is beautiful. But also I'd forgotten about the interior of the original car.
Asha
interior is incredible. So this sort of like mod meets like sort of psychedelic plaid pattern, I guess, of the seats are really great. You guys, I was reading, Brett, I think you were doing the same thing. I went down a little rabbit hole on this car and I was reading the Car and Driver review, the first drive of it from 78, which David E. Davis wrote. So it's great. And it was like, this is real car journalist nerd shit, but Porsche sent both, or I guess at the time, Car and Driver sent both David E. Davis, the editor-in-chief, and Brock Yates on the program. Both, there was no like video, like they didn't need two guys, but both the guys went on the program. And there's this awesome part in the review where they were saying when they first, they're first driving, something about like the off-gassing of the interior or some of the like glue that they were using was so strong that it was making Yates sick. Like he got car sick almost immediately when he was driving the car, even when they turned the vents on full and they ended up having to drive with the windows down. And David E. had a great line about there being like, this would never happen in an American car, basically. Like they would have sorted out the air conditioning and the HVAC to the point where it would have sucked the smell out of the car. But still ultimately like really loved it, loved driving it too. So this is just, I don't know, like, would you say that this is an iconic Porsche? I don't know if it's like, it's not quite in the mainstream, certainly not in the same way as like a 911, but it's a car that I immediately like recognize as being an important part of my childhood, right?
It's, I don't think it was always that way. I think they were looked down on for a really long time.
Well, but no, you had two camps. Like you had two very strident Porsche camps. There was the 911 folks and the front engine folks. And like, cause my neighbor in 1994 had a first model year 928, and he would have never touched a 911 with a 10-foot pole. Like he was a 928, 944 guy through and through. So I don't know that it's like
the weirdos.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of just like the alt Porsche folks. So I don't know.
They're
but yeah, cool, I think cars. It's super iconic choice.
Plus the Risky Business.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Classic.
That gave it a lot more visibility too. I had to share this too, because I just have never seen this before. I gotta zoom in a little bit on this. But on the Wikipedia for 928, they have a GIF of the headlights. So I know.
I love the headlights on those.
They make them look like little fun little Pokemon.
Yeah.
Happy little frog.
Mm-hmm. Also, isn't it just nice that Wikipedia has in 2024 GIF technology or GIF technology? I don't actually have a strong.
Clearly people's donations are going to the right things. I think we can all agree.
I remember when I was like probably 4 or 5, my dad, he had a GTI at the time, a Mark II GTI at the time. And I remember we went and drove a 928.
Your dad was cool.
So weirdly, no, I like the man has terrible taste in cars.
Sorry, Dad.
He's cool. He's cool in so many ways. The way in which he refuses to take anyone's advice on cars, his two sons who literally work in the automotive industry cannot get through to him about what cars are good. So anyway, but no, so he did have a GTI, which was pretty cool. I think he like happened upon it. I think he like a friend was selling it, and so he's like, okay, cool, I guess I'll buy it, blah 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 blah. Anyway, but I do remember he kind of like went through a phase where like he wanted to spend some money. He's usually not much of a money spender, but he kind of was like, oh, I want to like do these things. And it wasn't a midlife crisis, but it was something akin to that. And we went and drove a 928, and he was thinking about buying it for a little while. And it was, I remember, I think it was black over tan. It was tan leather. It wasn't the Pasha, but I do remember just like the like little bucket back seats back there, I thought were like the coolest little thing for my little 4-year-old butt. And I just thought it was so much fun to ride around in this Porsche. And we didn't end up buying it, obviously, but still kind of like a very cool car. I think if we talked about magic wands of reliability last couple weeks ago, and I think this is one of the cars that I would wave it on for sure.
Yeah, a 7-foot long timing belt does come with other issues, I think. Yeah.
All right, Kyle, we have time for one more. Let's why don't you give us your last one and then we'll get out of here.
Yeah, you betcha. I'm going a slightly different direction this time. We're leaving Europe, mainland Europe.
It's terrifying.
We're going to the racetrack and indeed to Sweden with the 240 240 turbo. This is in particular, I think the DTM sort of group A spec. These cars are so, we talked about this last week, Seth, obviously, but these cars are so phenomenal. Like they're so good. Like they're slow and boring in stock form, but like with a turbo and some handling modifications, they are shockingly capable. As you know, obviously Volvo wouldn't have bothered taking them racing if they didn't think it'd be competitive. And
were these body on frame or was it unibody?
These are unibody. Yep.
Cool.
Unibody, this is a 2.1 liter four cylinder because it's the turbo motor. Bosch K-Jetronic, just an oil cooled turbo. You know, nothing fancy. They got things got better later, but yeah, like they're just rad. Like they handle really well. They got that Dana 30 rear axle. They've got, you know, decent suspension. You know, it doesn't take a lot to make them handle really well. I had a pair of 240 turbo wagons and then just like a smorgasbord of other Volvos. Like I a big deep love of Volvo.
The 242 though especially I think is such a weirdo in the best possible way. The fact that they just had, you know, like a 240 sedan and they're like, what if we just weld up the rear doors and make it a coupe? How would that go?
Let's give these fools something sporty. Which is funny because they also did the 262 GT, which is like the chop top Bertone styled one, which is so bizarre. It's
so really weird.
And it had the PRV V6, which is also not amazing. The 780 Bertone, however, is rad. And there's a guy lives not that far from me that has like three of them. I see street parked, and every time I drive by, I'm just like, God bless you, sir. You know. But yeah, anyway, so the 240 Volvo is just, it's iconic, you know, like it just doesn't get any better or more 80s or, you know, I think, I mean, feel free to correct me if you know, I think it still has the Volvo 240 family in general still has the lowest instance of driver fatality in accidents of any car ever. If memory serves, it was the case for decades. I mean, that may have been surpassed now, but it's, you know, it's, they're just great.
That's a super interesting one. I mean, I would believe it, but also we've heard Volvo messaging about like their safety record for my entire,
right. Life.
So there's that.
Yeah. So this, like, this was like reported independently and I was really into like, and also like the climate control vents look like Oreos, the vent knobs look like Oreos, and that's pretty dope.
So as of 1994, absolutely no driver of the 1998 through 1992 Volvo 240 died in a car accident. That's kind of amazing. Of all the ones that they sold, that 6-year span, not one driver died in a car accident. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. That's incredible. That's what happens when you build the entire car around the heater core, apparently. The whole thing. It's a heater core with an engine and wheels. I know because I've had to replace one, and it was one of the worst things I've ever had to do in a car.
Just sell the car.
Seriously.
But yeah.
You pay for the mental well-being at that point. Just make a mechanic do it.
Yeah, well, I thought, like, this is going to be great because I'm going to save all this money on a $500 car. And then by the end of it, I was praying for death. Like, let a meteor hit me right in the face. Like,
how many of us have been in that exact situation before? It's very relatable.
And then once you started, you can't stop, you know.
You gotta keep going. And that's where you've developed so many of your project scars, by way of Volvo.
Literal and figurative, yes.
I love that feeling of like when you get to the like 45% point on a project and you're like, I could button this up right now and take it to a mechanic, and that, like, what would that just be like? I remember when we did the valve cover gasket in the Land Cruiser, we literally had the engine off or had the valve cover off, and we're like, we could just put it back on and take it to a mechanic right now. Do we want to do that? And we didn't, and it worked out fine. So, but
that path is called the Meersma way, Brett. There is like 10% of exploration, like a strong realization that I don't want to do any more work and would like to just drink beer. And then I just call the wrecker to bring it away, to bring it to the shop. So,
your poor little cars, just, they didn't have a chance.
My priority is always the local economy.
That's big of you. I appreciate that.
I know, I'm mad.
And so does Ann Arbor, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where's your parade?
This has been super fun, you guys. This actually, doing this today reminds me, and I'd love to have feedback. First of all, if anybody is watching this after the fact, leave us a comment on YouTube. We would love to hear what your favorite car from your birth year is, or the one that you maybe bought or would love to buy, or that you're dreaming of buying. If you feel like it, you can write us an email, tips@carid.com. We'll find us, and we would love to talk about your story after the fact. As ever, if you guys are watching again, like down the road and catch us live, you can throw a comment up. I forgot to say that this time, but hopefully by now people are starting to get the gist of that. What I was going to say is we should plan out a time. I know that next week it looks like we might have a guest on. I'm going to be on vacation, so I think that you guys are going to have some fun stuff to talk about. We're going to try and get a few new faces like into the mix as well. Kyle, the Volvo, talking about Volvo again reminded me. I would love to do a thing where we all talk about like a single brand in terms of like what we are interested in buying, like cars that we've owned, problems that we've had with specific brands. I mean, we already know that we've got a lot to say in terms of like Volvo and BMW. I don't know. We could dip into like Suzuki and Toyota, I'm sure are fruitful topics. But yeah, like I think those would be really fun to do every once in a while. So again, anybody out there, if you guys have a particular brand or particular car that you would love to hear about, know more about, that we could research up a little bit for an episode, I think that would be super fun too. So
definitely. Absolutely.
All right. This has been a great one. Brett's got to get out of here. The rest of us have to go back to normal work. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you again next week, Wednesday, as always at 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern time here for Project Scars. Thanks, guys.
Vaya con Dios.
Good day.